Hello and welcome. It's been a week that's seen the anniversary of the brutal Hamas attacks on October the 7th, a multi-fronted war now taking place a year on, with Israel poised to carry out a counter-strike in Iran at any time. The country's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, saying it will be lethal, precise and above all, surprising. Meanwhile, UN peacekeepers injured in Israeli fire in southern Lebanon. World leaders are demanding answers.
Obviously, I condemn the fact that there was shooting against the UN premise, wounding two peacekeepers, which is a violation of international humanitarian law. Peacekeepers must be protected by all parties of the conflict. And what has happened is obviously condemnable.
It's been a week that's seen a hurricane devastate the east coast of the US. Millions of people left without power, and rescuers searching through the floods waters for survivors in Florida. What started as a Category 5 predicted storm eased slightly, though fears were made clear. This US meteorologist struggling to comprehend the scale as the data came through.
It's just an incredible, incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific.
And it's been a week where two works of art have been trashed by critics, albeit first unwittingly. The repairman at a Dutch museum mistook these meticulously painted artistic recreations of the Belgian beer Jupiler for the real thing, and he binned them. And similar sentiments expressed by cinema-goers around the world this week after the release of Joker Folie à Deux, the much-anticipated sequel to Joker. After laughing all the way to the bank after the Oscar-winning billion-dollar box office success of the original, not this time.
Showtime.
With me from the World Press Corps and beyond this week, the journalist and author Agnès Poirier, whose book, The Left Bank, Art, Passion and the Rebirth of Paris, recently made it to the top five of The Economist's five most needed summer reads. A rebirth for the book itself, Agnès.
Well, it was a divine surprise.
Tell us about it. We're seeing it with a beautiful cover on this version as well. Tell us what it is, because I want to read this to you.
American cover. The British one is actually better. I shouldn't be saying this.
Let me say this to you. The critics say Agnès Poirier's chronicle of the city's modish past is a stylish feast.
Well, people should read it and make their own opinion. It's about, Paris, 1940, 1950, and a lot of things happened there. Not only the occupation, but what came after. And Paris was this epicenter of ideas, of utopias. The first assembly of the UN took place at the Trocadero. A lot of things happened then, and a lot of failures, but also some successes. And that was just before the Cold War started. So really, they tried to find a third way, although that's not how they called it, between, the US and Soviet Russia. And it, the European Union actually was born then, at least in ideas. Yeah.
A little light, a little hope in what seems like a dark time at the moment. Leila Jacinta, International Affairs Editor at France 24. Evening, Leila.
Hello.
Now, you've been monitoring developments in Lebanon for the past 7 days. Tell me about your observations. What struck you this week?
Well, I've been monitoring Lebanon for decades now. And what strikes me actually is deja vu, is how much history is repeating itself. And, 25 years ago, Israel pulled out of southern Lebanon with a bloody nose. It's back again in southern Lebanon. In 1982, Israel invaded southern Lebanon with this big plan to have a pro-US, pro-Israel government. That did not happen, and now we have these messianic views of reconfiguring the Middle East. So it's history repeating itself.
History repeating itself. Dave Clark, also joining us, who's seen a lot of history in your time, seasoned correspondent of Agence France-Presse in Paris at the moment, remembered by many, including me for your time in Brussels. You've covered more deployments than the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse to pretty grim places in the past. And you've between a lot of different jobs right now. I'm right to say in Kenya, you've been to South Africa. You're all over the place.
I'm going to Nigeria next, but my last full-time job for AFP was in Brussels. And that was very fun when we were covering Brexit. But, you know, that the fun had to come to its end at some point, and Michel Barnier came back to Paris to take up a new job, and so have I.
Might be getting you to explain what Jupiler beer is as well at some point in this programme. Dave is our Belgian expert. Also in London, Oliver McTurnan joins us, co-founder and director of Forward Thinking, and a former Catholic priest who spent more than two decades working in conflict and resolution in the Middle East. Great to have you on the programme with us, Oliver. I know from your past, you're a man that finds hope in the bleakest of situations. What sustains a sense of hope for you right now in the midst of a multi-fronted conflict of the Middle East?
I think knowing people on all sides of this conflict, people who have sound judgment and who are capable of finding a solution that would be durable and would bring a sustainable stability to the region. That's the source of hope for me. And if you've been around long enough, you do develop those relationships and knowledge of people in that way. But that said, I think we're at a very, very dangerous and precarious moment.
I think you're right. And that takes us into our first big issue of the week. At the beginning of the week, seeing commemorations across Israel, marking 1 year on from the biggest attack of the Jewish population since the Holocaust. The first anniversary of the October the 7th atrocities came as Israel fights an intense and escalating war on multiple fronts. Ground and air warfare in Gaza, now in Lebanon too. Tens of thousands killed. Iranian-backed militants of Hamas and Hezbollah the targets. The UN peacekeepers shot at directly at the UN base, they say, three times in 48 hours. Four injuries reported in what the UN describes as a grave violation of international law. Meanwhile, Western allies, including France, are demanding answers. Israel's ambassador to the UN says its peacekeepers should pull further back from the border. Israel claims the UN hasn't fulfilled its mandate of preventing Hezbollah to the area and needs to push back.
There is only one path forward, implementing Resolution 1701 and 1559. Demand that the Lebanese army and UNIFIL finally fulfill their obligations and take up the tasks they are mandated to carry out. Support Israel in our necessary operations to push Hezbollah back to the Litani River.
Well, all this comes in a week of mass Iranian ballistic strikes, which were 10 days ago, and the wait for a retaliatory counterstrike pending. President Biden speaking for the first time in 2 months to Benjamin Netanyahu, who's reported to have been told the details of what could come next. "Keep me in the loop," he told his Israeli counterpart. What we know is the country's defense minister hinted at this.
"Whoever attacks us will be hurt and pay a price. Our attack in Iran will be deadly, precise, and above all, surprising. They will not understand what happened or how it happened."
Let's start in London. And Oliver, we are still awaiting the next retaliation. Israeli media reported about today that there might be no definitive decision as yet, but the idea of escalate to de-escalate, the Israeli mantra right now, reshaping the power balance in the Middle East. What do you think?
Well, as I said at the beginning, I think we're at a very dangerous moment in not just regional history, but global history. I fear that Netanyahu has taken over the narrative, taking control of the narrative again. He was on the back foot with pressure from the families of the hostages, you know, who were pushing him to make a ceasefire so that their relatives could return home. And then suddenly we see this action in Lebanon, and in particular the early actions of the, first of all, the pagers and then the walkie-talkies being exploding. That recaptured the narrative for him and support among the Israeli population. And I think now he's on a war footing, and he's banking on the fact that if he provokes Iran enough, America will come to his support. And that's what worries me, the failure of Biden to have any red lines. As he said at the very beginning of this conflict a year ago, there are no red lines. And he's proven that throughout by conceding.
Leila, listening to Oliver talking about Joe Biden, the red lines just disappearing, it kind of does feel like Benjamin Netanyahu has a free hand, and his popularity since the Lebanon incursion seems to have increased slightly as well, and his cabinet's got bigger.
Yes, and you know, the core of the problem from the Israeli security point of view, no official investigation or report on the security failures that led to the Hamas attack. I mean, there's so much to unpick over here. Primarily, Biden's failure to rein in Israel, you know, hug Israel close, but in the end, has not managed to have any de-escalation at all, which comes at a time when we're just weeks away from the US election. But this has also had the effect of putting the spotlight on what has been going on for decades in the US internal domestic system, which is the very powerful Israeli lobby and how beholden US politicians are to Israel. So, I mean, we've got this few weeks. It seems pretty evident that Netanyahu is really pushing his agenda. And now, I mean, you talked about the different fronts that Israel is fighting on. Don't forget there's Yemen, there's Syria, and now the UN as well. I mean, Israel has had a consistent attacking of the UN systems, and even that is happening right now.
Yeah, they're talking about not recognising the way the UN is functioning at the moment. You're right to say as well, the seven fronts that the Prime Minister keeps talking about in Israel, Iraq, Syria as well, Yemen. Dave, you've spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I've spent a lot of time in Beirut, and I've never seen, certainly reported, that the centre's been struck before, even back in 2006. We're hearing this week that the centre being struck, residential areas, in that continued effort to find the chain of command within Hezbollah. Tell me about the atmosphere when you're back and forth to the Middle East and what you make of this week.
Well, I was in our Middle East editing center, which is actually in Cyprus, so it's safe. But it's just across the sea from Beirut, and a lot of our staff there are Lebanese. They were very frightened for their families. There's a sense that they've been through it all before, as Leila was discussing. But something that's different this time, I think, and what makes it feel so vertiginous that we're on the edge of something much bigger, is that in the past there's always been a sense that eventually America has a great influence in the region, and for various reasons they've lost that influence now. And so that's one possible stabilizing factor. I mean, I know there's been a lot of criticism of their intervention in Iraq didn't actually lead to more stability, and indeed in Libya and to an extent in Syria. But they were the final backstop. And it does not appear, despite this meeting between Netanyahu and Biden, that Washington has a restraining influence. There's an extent to which I think it's wishful thinking that we want the United States to restrain Israel. They've got a lot of shared policies, and they're both enemies of Hezbollah. But even this things that the Americans have stated in public that the Israelis shouldn't do, they've just gone ahead and done. And the Americans have spokespeople are scrambling to update their talking points every day and endorse things that they were campaigning against last week.
And yes, Dave, talking about the US supposed to be that point of stability, a guidance, a rudder. The UN also supposed to be that on the border of Lebanon, peacekeepers this week being shot at. Quite a complicated situation. Israel saying, push back. You've basically not done your job of trying to stop Hezbollah militants being here. What do you make of what's going on?
Look, there's an element of truth. That's the thing. I mean, it's so complicated. I mean, I do understand Israel's contempt for the UN in that they found a lot of people within the UN agency in Gaza to be working for Hamas, then, you know, I mean, it's very shocking that Israeli soldiers should shoot at, you know, directly at UN peacekeepers. But on the other hand, Lebanon hasn't had a state. I mean, there's no functioning state, hasn't had, you know, for years. Mm. Hezbollah has filled the void. So, they are completely, and they are run from Tehran. So, you know, yeah, you have a lot of sympathy for Lebanon, but there's no state. There are clans, there are families. The last president was assassinated. He tried to do something else. And Hezbollah, like Hamas, are using civilians as shields. And Israel is just surrounded by enemies. On the other hand, Netanyahu is moving the goalposts all the time, and American policy move with them. Mm-hmm. And so President Macron, a few days before the anniversary of the 7th of October, and that was, he was heavily criticized, perhaps for the timing, but not only, but what he was trying to say, perhaps very clumsily. He did name the American administration, but he was talking about the Americans on one hand saying, oh, yes, we need a ceasefire, we need the end of hostilities. On the other hand, not applying pressure and giving a lot of money and weapons to Israel. Perhaps those conversations should be done behind closed doors between European leaders and their American counterparts rather than, at an interview. But some pressure must be applied. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, that concept of total victory, as the Prime Minister of Israel says, I mean, what is total victory exactly? Especially in the Middle East. I mean, Israel is surrounded by enemies. At some point, you need to make peace with your neighbors, just for the sake of the civilians everywhere. So, you know, a diplomat who was privy to the negotiations, if you remember in July in Rome, said, now we've lost the horizon. You know, we don't know where we're going. It's like being in the open sea and not seeing the shore. And this feels like, you know, for everyone looking. But the world, it's not only in the Middle East. The world is perhaps not on the brink, but, you know, it's a frightful.
Leila.
Well, I mean, just 2 points very quickly. I mean, if you heard the Israeli ambassador to the UN talking about implementing these resolutions, which, of course, have not been fully implemented in 1701 or 1556, you know, they talk
about... To explain 1701, after the 34-day war, this was the idea of Hezbollah moving back across, up above the Latani River.
Right.
And so that's what Israel are currently saying to the idea, to the UN peace keepers, move back 5 kilometres, and they won't. They're doing their job, they say.
Right. So they have decided, their host countries have decided to keep them there. But, you know, the resolutions call for the UN to secure this area up to the Litani and for Hezbollah to be disarmed, which did not happen. Mm. However, when, you know, you go to the UN Security Council and talk about the Lebanese state maintaining security and the Lebanese army, you know, we just get caught in the, you know, talking about the news cycle. The Lebanese army, as I have to explain repeatedly these days, is very weak. But it is the one institution that is truly national in a country that has sectarian divisions, as you mentioned. But this is also a country that Israel continues to destabilize. Mm. And, you know, and your to your point about making peace, Israel has not made peace with its neighbors. But much more importantly, Israel refuses to make peace with the Palestinians, and that is the root of the of this crisis. And for a year, we've been just discussing what happens in the news since October 7th. But essentially, that is the root of the problem. Lebanon has been destabilized by a mass displacement of Palestinians. That was the root of the problem when it went to civil war. So, how are we? You know, what's the political aim of this incursion, really?
It is really interesting, actually, Leila, and I want to put that to Oliver. That, not just that, Oliver, but to something still in my head about what Anya said a short while ago about how trying to mediate a ceasefire before, those people are no longer feeling like there is a horizon right now. You've been involved in mediation. Are you, you know, at the moment putting your hands up in the air going, now is not our time?
First of all, I just like to make the point that the history of this conflict didn't begin on October the 7th. And I think sometimes when we talk about it and Israel's right to defend itself, it's locked within that narrative. The conflict is 75 years old. And let's face it, we are faced with Hezbollah. It grew out of the Israeli invasion in 1982, which was aimed at expelling the PLO from Lebanon. So there is a long history of infringements, and I'd say the root cause of the conflict is essentially occupation. And we've had several UN resolutions that have been ignored regarding the occupation. I think unless Israel now wakes up and says we have to address the core issue, and that is our occupation of Gaza, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, as well as the Sheba Farms, that they are part of that. Unless they're prepared to acknowledge that, I fear Israel will never have the security it deserves and has a right to. Everyone has a right to defend themselves, but we equally have to respect the rule based order that grew out of World War II. And my big anxiety and fear is we're seeing that unraveling every day before our eyes. There seems to be absolutely no accountability. We're writing new rules. And the basic is, if you've got the mic to do it, you're right. So that's the complicated situation. We have to say, is it possible to find a solution? Yes, it is, if there's the political will to do so.
Yeah, good point. And right now we're in a kind of triage of information about where the next front is and what's happening, like the UN or in Gaza in the north. Oliver, good to have your assessment. Well, one of the more surprising elements in the news this week, at least to analysts of the Ukraine war, was the intelligence chiefs in Kyiv saying North Korean soldiers had been killed on the battlefield supporting Russia in occupied Donetsk. The news only came after a speculative comment by the South Korean defense minister at the start of the week, who said there would be a good chance North Korean troops would be sent to fight in support of Putin's war. When reporters asked the Ukrainian government, a response came from Andrei Kovalenko of the Ukraine Center for Countering Disinformation. He said this: it's already happening, and gave an example of six North Korean soldiers killed in a Ukrainian missile strike. Well, for Kremlin, Vladimir Putin's office was asked. They claim it's fake news. Meanwhile, President Zelensky back on diplomatic maneuvers this week, showing European leaders his so-called, as yet secretive, victory plan while drumming up more support for money, weapons, defence capabilities. Let's see the red carpet moment in London. There he is with Keir Starmer at Downing Street on Thursday morning. A brief handshake, barely an exchange with Larry the Cat. And then maybe the PM's not a cat person, but maybe he didn't have time. Let's move across the channel to Paris. Just after 4 o'clock Thursday, meeting with there's Larry again. Okay, there's Larry's thoughts of the day. At the red carpet for Larry. Let's go to President Macron at the Elysee Palace as well, the meeting on Thursday.
Larry.
Under heavy skies, incessant rain there. Then in Rome by the evening, three capitals in one day, meeting Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Fast forward the morning after, an audience with the Pope at the Vatican, who presented him with a display, a flower display of peace. And 24 hours later, let's take a look at the reception reactions in Berlin with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. And what we heard from that meeting in the past few hours, that there is a deadline set, Dave, talking about 2025, by 2025, for Vladimir Zelensky, if this victory plan works. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, if he had a victory plan, he probably should have put it into operation before now. I remember there was going to be a great offensive this year and last year, for that matter. I was there, and it was a disaster. If you remember, looking at all those diplomatic meetings this week, I'm reminded of two things, really. One, the Europeans used to be really excited to meet Zelensky. It was a big boost for them with their own electorates and with the media. They'd love to be photographed with him. It was all smiles. It felt like we were building some European coalition. And now he's just begging for his life now. He cuts a tragic figure. The other thing that makes me think about, there was somebody he didn't meet this week. There was President Biden, who has a hurricane to deal with and is a lame duck in his own right. But I know this. It was the weather that meant that Biden couldn't come, but it's also a kind of preview of how the world will look for the Ukrainians after November the 7th if Donald Trump wins.
And yes.
Well, I mean, it's like with the Middle East. I mean, everybody's waiting for the U.S. elections, and so is Zelensky, and like Netanyahu, except Netanyahu wishes for Donald Trump to be elected, and Zelensky wishes for Kamala Harris to be elected, and nothing will happen until then. It's almost everything is frozen, and Russia is taking advantage of it because it's making ground and gains in eastern Ukraine. I mean, you know, Kyiv is clinging on the Kursk region, but we don't know anything about this victory plan. You know, we know there are steps until Christmas. You know that. Zelensky would like to see his European partners and allies and the Americans to give him authorization to use those long-range missiles inside Russia. He was hoping for Biden to green-light it, but it didn't happen and probably won't happen before the elections. He also met, I think, with Keir Starmer, NATO's new chief, Mark Rutte, because he liked the membership to be speeded. But some people who saw the victory plan in Washington regretted the lack of overall strategy. So there's an element of this now tragic figure. You know, before he was this heroic, I mean, he's still heroic, obviously. And we also know that, you know, that the Ukrainian soldiers have been fighting for so long. They are, you know, they're enrolled heroically right at the beginning, and they are exhausted.
Yeah.
And there are lots more desertion. And also the other thing too is European partners. I mean, look at them. Macron is weakened. Olaf Scholz is weakened. Biden is weakened, and anyways, is not going to be around for much longer anymore. And so it's
in
not
fact
as
of
yet.
All of those, probably Giorgia Meloni is in the strongest position right now, isn't she?
Yes, but Italy is not as powerful as America. Everybody looks weakened, and the Ukrainian cause as well.
North Koreans on the battlefield, say Ukraine. Surprise to you, Leela?
Well, it did come as a surprise, but then when I gave it a thought, it's actually not that much of a surprise. All sorts of people have been fighting in Ukraine for Russia, including Afghans. For North Koreans, it's an ability to get some battle experience, frontline experience, you know, get some technical know-how from the Russians. And ultimately, you know, North Korea drawing closer to Russia and China against an ever weakening West. I have to say, Gavin, before the war in Gaza, I was keenly looking at the Global South reaction to the Ukraine war. And at that point, people in the Global South were telling me, this is Europe's problem. And we were dismayed. We were caught by shock on how the Global South just did not seem to come on board against Russian aggression, which was against the post-war order. And a year after the Israeli war in Gaza and Lebanon, a lot of people that I'm talking to in the Global South are telling me, see, we were right. This is Europe's problem. And if it is Europe's problem, it also shows how weak Europe is. You know, the entire security structure is built on the American security umbrella. The U.S. has always, veered towards isolationism and multilateral engagement. Mm. And, you know, Zelensky still does not have, you know, basic permission to use European missiles into Russia. You know, we've talking about German Taurus missile system, British missile system. Mm. So the West is looking so weak and without a plan.
Weak and without a plan. Oliver, can I ask you what you made this week? Another moment this week, the launch of Boris Johnson's autobiography, Unleashed. Now, he claimed to reporters this week when he was selling it, he said he thought Vladimir Putin, quote, would not have invaded Ukraine if Donald Trump remained in the White House in 2020. What do you make of that?
I think it's a rather superficial judgment. And frankly, it does reflect the sort of judgments that Johnson would make. I think it's Ukraine is a much more serious issue. And I think even with Trump there, Putin would have rescued it. Because let's remember, he tested the water with Georgia, nothing happened. He tested the water further with Crimea, nothing happened. Mm. So there was no reason why, for his own domestic reasons, he shouldn't have moved on Ukraine. And I think he would have acted, Trump in power or not.
Oliver, thank you. Well, let's move on to developments here in France, because Thursday night was budget night, scarier night than Halloween for those waiting for the announcement of Prime Minister Michel Barnier. And austerity is now the mot de jour for a French government to trying to balance its books, something that would have been, well, it's been incapable, France, in fact, of balancing the books since 1974. So France at an inflection point, gone is the COVID era, whatever it takes rhetoric of the president. The mantra now, open wide. This is going to hurt.
I want to mark this period, however long it lasts, with an honest and responsible effort towards the French people. So we're going to ask the French people to make an effort of 60 billion. I want this effort to be fair and balanced. In fact, in terms of savings, it will be spread over a sum of 40 billion, with everyone doing their bit.
Well, that is, if the minority government can pass the bill in Parliament. And Michel Barnier's feeling buoyed. He's passed his first prime ministerial test, a confidence vote bought by the left wing to oust him. Although they are still a presence like Banquo's ghost at the table, they argue, we won the July election, he doesn't represent us. So, Agnès, talk us through your take on the budget announcement.
Well, the budget...
Everyone's talking about 1983 and how suddenly it's going back decades, austerity back on the table.
Well, I mean, it's cruel irony in the sense that the French economy in the last 7 years with that pro-business agenda of Macron, it's not been doing badly, you know. The unemployment has been really lowered significantly. I mean, to the point where we don't talk about the unemployment as the biggest problem.
We had a brief interruption by Michel Barnier. Carry on. We'll go to Barnier in a moment. Michel, if you can just hang on. Agnès is finishing. Carry on. He's watching.
Also, you know, foreign direct investment in France. You know, France is biggest European country. I mean, the country where foreign direct investment is just flowing, you know, for the 5 years running. But President Macron is also responsible for not having curtailed at all government spending during those 7 years. So he's achieved a lot, but he's also let public spending just go on. Of course, there are accidents and crises that were not foreseeable, the pandemic, also the Ukrainian war. And each time he's tried to shield consumers and the French citizens who are not at all grateful. That's the way the French are. They are not grateful. But he still did it. But when you look also at the other reasons why public spending has been, you know, skyrocketing, is pensions. So it's, you know, no political leader, or at least, you know, the far right, the far left, also a lot in the left, want to repeal the pension reform. When actually, if you look at figures, it should have gone further, like all European neighbours, you know, who some of them are working until the age of 67 because it cost the state a lot of money, too much money. So, you know, so this budget is not you know, making anyone happy, because it doesn't really cut public spending so much. And, public's expenditure in France is, you know, the highest in Europe. It could do with some reform or being managed better. And also there are quite a lot of tax rises for business and the wealthiest. But will it be enough?
Let's take a look. You just mentioned the tax. Let's take a look. This is our colleague, friend of the program, Sophie Pedder at The Economist. This was the graph from The Economist this week about how heavily the French are taxed. If we can see it, and Gallery can bring it up, essentially showing us that of all the OECD countries, French tax to GDP is the highest. So it's going to be a tough ask. Dave, just arriving from Brussels to Paris. The argument you can put forward from the government past is that this is the work-life balance, protections for the workers, good retirement. What's the view from Brussels over perhaps profligacy of France?
Well, yeah, I'm moving back to Paris just when taxes are going up and public spending is getting slashed.
Are you that wealthy, though?
terrible timing for this Brussels former Brussels resident. And there's a lot of French people who live in Brussels because they were avoiding a former tax, the impôt sur la fortune. Income tax is actually pretty high in Brussels, but people get out of it in various ways. The thing that strikes me as a former Brussels correspondent is that in the debate here in France, we're talking about the French national budget like it's independent, but the 3% deficit target is imposed on it by the stability mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I do have concerns that if the French electorate starts to associate austerity with European Union membership or membership of the Euro, this will boost Eurosceptic forces. And in any case, austerity just makes the electorate miserable, and miserable electorates turn to extreme measures.
Well, we've seen it, haven't we, here in France? We've seen many protests, particularly as Agnes was saying a moment ago, when it came to the pensions reforms. Now, the other question is, it's been a good week for Michel Barnier, Lila. My question to you is this: he's quite high in popularity ratings right now. Is he the man for the job? Has he got what Gen Z call main character energy?
Oh, right. Now I'm supposed to look into the crystal ball. Look, it doesn't look good. This is a minority government, and they are making nobody happy. Tax cuts are not making the right happy, and tightening the belt austerity is not making the left happy. So this is going to be a difficult one. But I mean, when Agnes was talking, I was just thinking about, you know, there's the economics, there's also the politics, the messaging, and it is. I completely agree with you. You know, Macron did macronomics. You know, he's a former investment banker. He did boost the economy. The pandemic, of course, boost spending. But this seemed to come as a surprise to suddenly find that 6%, the deficit is at 6% of GDP. So obviously after
far worse than Spain or Italy or countries that used to be criticized as
exactly. So obviously after the pandemic, the belt tightening did not happen. But for that to happen, the politics and the messaging was so bad. All the reforms that had to be done, Macron just could not have the public on board. And so all these difficult things, which were going to be difficult in any way, the way he handled it, the way he was perceived to not take into account, public opinion, did not help him in any way, calling early elections. There was so much political heat, and these kind of measures, the public needs to understand. The public will not be happy, but it should not erupt. And a lot of this is personal style as well.
Personal style is very interesting. Dave and I will know the personal style of Michel Barnier very well, who's got to steer this through for the government from his time in Brussels as Mr. Negotiator for the EU. He tried to interrupt a short while ago. Let's have a listen to him in Parliament, jousting.
Monsieur Attal, I will be very mindful of your proposition. Very mindful. I know you, Mr. Ciotti, since a long time ago. I don't want to argue with you because I haven't got time.
Voilà.
briefly, Agnes, people say, my neighbours say, he's got an old-fashioned French style which they like.
Well, he's very... Well, he showed that style, actually, during the Brexit negotiations. He's extremely courteous. In a way, he's quite British, in the best sense. And in a way, the British negotiators were not. So he's courteous, he's very patient, he works his dossiers. Now he doesn't have his 73. He's not, you know, he's not going to seek election as a president.
I wouldn't rule that out. He came back to Paris. The last off the record I had with him, he was very clear why he was going back to Paris.
Cliffhanger.
But he responded to an attack and to actually the style of the far left, which is abhorrent in insulting him. He said, "The more you insult me, the more I'll be." Quarters to you. And so he might wrong foot his political enemies. On the other hand, he's in...
And he hasn't got a majority to lose, so he may as well just put it all out there.
But he's in an impossible situation.
And a policy of when they go low, we'll go high. Okay, next, a story of modern art is rubbish trope, illustrated at the LAM Museum in the Netherlands this week, when the work of French artist Alexandre Levay, called All the Good Times We Spend Together... This is it. Went missing from the gallery. Turns out the repairman, tasked with fixing the lift, saw it, thought it was a couple of cans of leftover Belgian beer, chucked them in the bin. This is in a week where not just one, but two works of art have been trashed by critics, albeit the first, unwittingly now we know, in the Netherlands. The other, it was the worldwide release of this highly anticipated Joker 2, Folie à Deux. The original came out in 2019. Rapturous applause, an 8-minute standing ovation at the Cannes Festival. Judges described it as a cinematic masterpiece. Joaquin Phoenix landing best Oscar for best actor for it too. $1 billion at the box office this week. The sequel, a movie musical. They weren't laughing all the way to the bank. It lost money at the box office, being critically panned. Rotten Tomatoes reviews say it's the lowest rating for a comic book movie ever. Let's take a look at a snippet from the trailer.
I got the sneaking suspicion that we're not giving the people what they want.
It's okay, baby. Let's give the people what they want.
But here's the thing. Who cares? A bit like Alexandre Levay and his Jupiler, what does he care if a mechanic mistakes it for rubbish? It turns out they duck the beers out, they clean them, even more people are coming to see the work. And Todd Phillips, the director of The Joker, he said this week. He loves it. He stands by it. Whatever fans think, I do not care. So it leads the question, artistic freedom, creative choice versus expectation, reception. So we're asking the panel, does criticism influence your decision to see something? Oliver, starting with you.
Well, no. And listening to that, I'm afraid that I could give the Joker a miss. it wouldn't make me rush to the box office. But if you get a good review of an artist's work or some sculpture, I think there is a tendency to go and see it for yourself and make your own assessment of it.
And yes, would you be running to the IMAX even if others, like Oliver said, he might not, but if others turn up the nose, do criticism bother you?
Well, I started my career as a film critic, so and I still do occasionally do film criticism. Look, it does matter. Reviews do matter for small films, for books under the radar, and for art house cinema. It's very important. And festivals like Cannes, like Venice, like Berlin, and smaller festivals are very important. Because sometimes it's the only place where, you know, you have all international critics that see a film, that can discuss it. And therefore, sometimes, you know, you've got all those wonderful stories of very, very small films, but they are masterpieces. And that's how they get to be bought by distributors in festivals, exhibitors. So, yes, criticism do matter. But for a film like The Joker, of course it doesn't. You know, it's huge. Hollywood films don't need, you know. But on the other hand, the career of Alfred Hitchcock was made by French film critics, you know, because he was considered as a commercial film director. And then suddenly some young French film critics of the New Wave, before they became directors themselves, say, hey, hang on a minute, this guy is a genius.
It takes us on, Dave. We have about 30 seconds, but I think you can do it in this time. The Netherlands exhibit gave a new lease of life to the French artist. The Jupiler can's being dug out the bin. Alexandre Levay is happy with it. Just for our non-Belgian friends out there, how would you describe the experience of a Jupiler?
Jupiler is not Belgium's best beer, but I'm not surprised that the Dutch didn't recognise good beer.
Perfectly summed up. Thank you from all of us. It's goodbye from the world this week. Thank you to Agnes Poirier, journalist and author, from Dave as well, Clark at AFP, Lila Jacinto here with us at France 24, and Oliver McTurn as well, co-founder of Forward Thinking. Thank you for watching. Judge for yourself. Put on a happy face. We'll see you back here in 7 days for the world next week.
I want to see the really.